Well, thank you first to Mark for inviting me to speak. It's really exciting for me to see a lot of young people at assemblies like this, and I hope that by some cross-fertilization between one specific area that I'm very familiar with over a long period of time and some newer areas of research that you guys are interested in, that we'll be able to inspire some progress in both science of agronomy and solar radiation research. First, some legal stuff. I'm a retired employee of the Alliance for Sustainable Energy, which operated the DOE National Renewable Energy Laboratory. And the opinions and results that are reflected here are my own and do not reflect on my former employees. And the mention of any industrial concerns or companies implies no endorsement, good or bad, with respect to anything that I'll show you. All the research is in the public domain, and a lot of it is available online. At the end of the presentation is a bibliography of a lot of research publications, some of them recent, which will enlighten you in the field of solar radiation that I'll talk about. Well, you're all familiar with why we are interested in solar radiation data. Of course, agriculture, agronomy, hydrology with respect to evaporation and photobiology, light and life are the main focus areas for this community. My background is in solar radiation for renewable resource applications. So we talk about solar radiation components in a slightly different manner than this community. Sure you're familiar with the fact that the direct beam that comes from the sun, has to pass through the atmosphere and gets absorbed and scattered and reflected, both from the ground and from clouds and the sky. And the energy that gets scattered from the sun, we call the diffuse sky radiation. If you block out with a shadowing device the disk of the sun, you get only energy from the diffuse sky. And if you take the direct beam that's measured with essentially a very narrow field of view detector looking at the sun and multiply by the cosine of the incidence angle and add in the diffuse, you get what's called the total hemispherical radiation. That's what a lot of people in your community refer to as the downwelling shortwave. Of course, there's long wave embedded in there too, but these radiometers measure shortwave radiation. I'll talk a little bit about long wave radiation in a moment. Of course, radiation evapotranspiration is one of the big areas of concern with respect to your community. And of course, I attended the evapotranspiration session yesterday and learned a great deal about the way the problems that you have and the very, very many ways that you have of calculating it, both direct and indirect. But that's the term that you guys are interested in, the net radiation, which is the difference between that downwelling shortwave and outgoing longwave radiation. And what the instruments that I'm familiar with, along with net radiometers, I didn't investigate sufficiently to provide examples of them on this slide, but the sensors for all solar radiation measurements are basically of two types. You've got the silicon-based or photodiode-based instruments and the thermopile-based instruments. The thermopile-based instruments are expensive. Most of the silicon-based instruments are relatively less expensive and smaller, and you can get a lot more replicates if you desire to improve your sampling over large areas or whatever. But they have certain limitations. By the way, all of these, I believe, except EPLI, are represented in the exhibit area downstairs, and I've spoken with and are actually have collegial relations with many of the people in this industry. But the main issue that we have with silicon instruments, that has plagued the broadband solar radiation community for a long time is this limited spectral response, which is represented by this small graph down here at the bottom. And just for clarity, this on the left is an example of the direct beam, the blue line, the global hemispherical or total solar radiation, and the diffuse radiation. And you can see that there are spectral differences between each of these. This is a clear sky spectra. And of course, clouds impact this enormously. And on the right, we have a similar graph of the total hemispherical spectral radiation, but you see the decreasing amplitude as the path length through the atmosphere increases. And not only the decreasing amplitude, but the change in shape might be hard to see. But as you go from nearly overhead to near the horizon, the spectral shape flattens out. The main problem with the silicon detectors, which include those that detect photosynthetically active radiation, and the photopic response, which is that of the eye outdoors, illuminance and luminance meters are based on the same kind of detectors, and the silicon pyranometer, which is utilized to measure total radiation when it's properly calibrated, they each have these respective spectral shapes for their response. This is the PAR response, the pink, the blue line is the photopic response, essentially a schematic of it, and this is the global solar radiation response. The problem is, especially for the agronomy community, you're missing all these water vapor absorption bands and the variation of the solar spectrum out in this region. And that leads to the fact that the silicon detectors do not respond to those changes out in that spectral region and increases the uncertainty. I'm glad to hear several of those speakers already mention the issues of calibration. There are calibration references which are recognized by the International Bureau of Weights and Measures as the reference for solar radiation measurements. That's the World Meteorological Organization World Reference Radiometer Group, which are pictured here. It's a collection of absolute cavity radiometers which use electrical substitution to substitute for electrical power to a sensor. When the sensor is shaded, you turn off the electrical power and you measure the solar radiance until you get an equivalent output, and you essentially have the radiance in watts per meter squared. So that reference has an uncertainty of 0.3% up until now. And I'll talk about that a little bit later, improvements on the way. But as you transfer from the World Radiation Reference Group to other measuring instruments, this uncertainty builds up. You have a transfer uncertainty, which is a combination of your reference uncertainty and the uncertainty in your instrument. Then you take that and your reference instruments that's been calibrated against the WRR, transfer that calibration to your field instruments, and that includes an increase in uncertainty. And also the method of calibration, which is based on that balance equation, global equals direct times cosine of the zenith angle plus the diffuse. Each of those components to include elements of uncertainty, the cosine of the zenith angle, and of course the diffuse measurement. So these all build up to give you these kinds of total uncertainties that you see here, which I quote for a pyroheliometer, which is measuring the direct beam, narrow, small field of view around the sun. The pyranometer, which is a thermopile pyranometer with the uncertainty on the order of plus or minus 5%, and I'll show you why that's the case. And then the silicon devices, which have uncertainties on the order of 8 to 15%. So here you see the relative uncertainties in the WRR calibration. You can calibrate these against lamps in the laboratory, but of course those have inherent uncertainty as well. And you need to know their spectral distributions, how they differ from the solar spectral distribution. And then you've got the transfer issue. And then you've got the big bugaboos, the recalcitrant problems, as this session is titled. The cosine response or angle of incidence response and the spectral response with respect to thermopile versus silicon detectors. So here's the main problem with geometric response. We have three different brands of pyranometers, or measuring the solar radiation here, here, and here. And this is a pyrheliometer for measuring the direct beam. What you see here along this direction is the time of day, or the incidence angle on this plot, the time of day. And you see that this error bar here represents 5% change. This error bar is a 3% change, and here with 4%. And you see in some radiometers, morning and afternoon are not very much different, but from noon to morning or noon to afternoon, there are large response errors. In terms of this instrument, we have an asymmetry between the morning and afternoon. So this is essentially the calibration, the way the calibration factor changes throughout the day if you were under calibration conditions on a clear day. And this would be due to some issue with leveling of the radiometer or the sensor with respect to whatever reference you use for leveling, or maybe even non-uniformities in the sensor sensing element absorbing layer. And in a silicon radiometer, we have similar issues because these usually have a diffuser on the top where you can have Fresnel losses, you can have non-parallelism between the diffuser and the sensor, non-uniformity of the diffuser, etc. So you get these kinds of asymmetries. And these are on the order of those numbers that were quoted earlier for the overall uncertainties. Well, you see, those were nice curves. Maybe I can model those curves. Maybe I can fit my data, my calibration data, to a function. And what a lot of people do is do that, and then they apply the functions, and they say, oh, I've got an improved measurement. What you need to recall is that when you're fitting data to, or curves to a data set, you have scatter about that regression line. And that scatter will be an additional source of uncertainty in your calculation of the total engineering units that you want out of your sensor in the end. Here's an example of an angle of incidence correction fit where there's a 4% scatter about the regression line. And this is an example of a silicon detector where you're comparing a thermal pile and a silicon detector, and you find that under clear and cloudy conditions, you get different lines. So how do you account for the differences between clear and cloudy conditions? So the future, progress. I mentioned the absolute cavity radiometer. These were invented about 1970 and are used to provide the reference. However, it's been determined that by comparisons with that world standard group of radiometers and measurements in the laboratory at National Physical Laboratory in Britain or the National Institute of Standards and Technology, that there's about a 0.34% difference between the SI reference unit for irradiance measured with a black body source in the laboratory and a high-accuracy cryogenic absolute cavity radiometer in the laboratory. And now the people at the World Radiation Reference, World Meteorological Organization, World Radiation Center in Davos, Switzerland, are trying to develop an absolute cavity radiometer that is cryogenically cooled to reduce noise and to produce more accurate reference for solar radiance measurements. So that's part of the solution to some of reducing the uncertainty in global radiation measurements and calibrations is to reduce the uncertainty in your references. And with respect to long-wave radiation, we have similar issues. This is the present sort of reference that is existing for measuring long-wave radiation, 3 microns to 15 or longer micron wavelengths. The integrating spheres radiometer at Davos is a World Radiation Reference people, is used at night to scan the sky and detect what the infrared irradiance distribution is over the sky, and compare that with the radiometers that are being calibrated. And they quote an uncertainty on the order of 1 or 2 watts per meter squared in their reference unit that results in a transfer calibration uncertainty of on the order of 2 to 4% in the units that they're calibrating. You can also take the infrared radiometers, put them in the laboratory under a black body source. In this case, it's a heated, here's the radiometer down at the bottom. You have an integrating sphere here with a temperature control bath where you can run the temperature up and down to generate the IR signal that the radiometer is measuring. And you know the temperature of the bath and the sphere and the radiometer, so you can do the calculation to tell you what the response of the radiometer is with respect to the known irradiance. And this produces an uncertainties on the order of 12 watts per meter squared in the laboratory. This is the way parageometers, which measure long wave radiation generally, are calibrated. You use one of those two reference techniques to generate a reference group of radiometers. You then put your field radiometers out there next to those reference radiometers and transfer the calibration to them. And then you put them out in the field to do your measurements. And using the black body temperature approach, we've obtained errors or differences on the order of 13 watts per meter squared, close to what was quoted in that black body frame in the previous slide. So the folks at NREL decided we need to have a simpler, easier reference to use for infrared calibrations. So one of my colleagues has developed this long wave absolute cavity pyrogeometer, which is essentially a pyrogeometer that looks a lot different from a regular pyrogeometer, but has a temperature control base where you can monitor the temperature of the base, and you also have thermistors embedded in this gold cavity to measure the temperature of the cavity and determine what the long wave radiation coming from the sky is. And this results in uncertainties on the order of 3 watts per meter squared with respect to that IRS scanning radiometer. The two were compared at Davos, and these are the measured differences that were obtained. So in summary, I think we all are suffering from some of the same issues with respect to measurements that Bruce mentioned and the previous speakers have mentioned. Present solar radiation uncertainties are in the order of 5 to 10% of full scale. 50 to 100 watts per meter squared at 1,000 watts per meter squared input. And those are all instrument dependent. Every instrument has its own signature. Every instrument has its own character. Methods to reduce uncertainties have been identified through climate change research and renewable energy research. And the scatter about fitting functions is often neglected in terms of your uncertainty budget when you start evaluating the uncertainties of your measurements. And most importantly, the inexpensive silicon photodiode detectors have limited spectral response, which are going to limit your accuracy, though you may be able to correct for that on site if you're able to do spectral measurements, for instance, on site to evaluate the impact. New solar standards, new reference standards for both solar and shortwave solar and long wave radiation are in the works, but that's only a small component of what you do in the field when you go from the reference instruments to the calibration laboratory and then out into the field. You have to account for all those transfers of uncertainty. I want to thank you for allowing me to talk, and wanted to mention in passing these two gentlemen who are highly influential in my career. James Kendall Jr. from JPL, just up the road here in Pasadena, was responsible for inventing the absolute cavity radiometer concept, and Edwin Flowers at NOAA calibrated thousands of radiometers over his 30-year career at NOAA for the National Weather Service for their measurement network. And if you get a chance to look at this online, there's a bibliography here of suggested reading, which will hopefully inform you about uncertainty analysis and solar radiation measurements. Thank you.